Okay, are we about ready to get started? Let's do that. Just to answer that question real quickly on which Quran to use, I would encourage you to get a Quran. Go ahead and do that. And for those of you who live in London, or I'm sorry, anywhere in Britain, I'm sure even in Italy, you can go to any mosque, just say that you're interested in reading the Quran, and they'll probably give it to you free. And they'll give you an Italian translation with Arabic. If they don't, ask them for a Arabic English or Arabic Italian side by side, for very good reasons. That if you quote from some of the things I'm going to give you today, they'll say it's not in the Quran. So then you can just open up and show exactly what we're talking about. These cost about £10. There are a number of English translations that you can use. They will want you to use this one, which is Yusuf Ali or Marmaduke Pictal. Marmaduke Pictal is a Pictal was a convert. Yusuf Ali is from Pakistan. Those are what I call apologetical translations. They're absolutely hopeless translations. Is that a question?
Yeah. How separate is Khan?
Khan is along the same lines as Marmaduke Pictal.
So that's okay. It's kosher for them.
It's kosher for them, but it's going to be a terrible translation. Yeah, okay. It's a halal one, yeah, you're right. It mistranslates right, left, and center. Case in point, if you open up Surah 4, Ayah 34, which is the famous verse about women, men are protectors of women, but if they should disobey you, then you may admonish them. And then after that, you may cast them from your bed, and then you may beat them lightly, it says. There's no lightly in the Arabic, and so they put the lightly in there for apologetical reasons. So they do this all the time. Surah 19:33, which talks about Jesus, and Jesus says about himself, "Blessed be on me the day that I was born, the day that I die, and the day that I rise again." Seeming to insinuate that he died and rose again. What they have done is they put it into a future tense. Blessed be me on me the day I was born, the day I will die, and the day I will rise again. But it's not in the Arabic. There's no future tense in the Arabic. And the easy way to know that is to go back to verse 15 in that chapter, chapter 19. To verse 15, which has John the Baptist saying exactly the same words. And he says, "Blessed be me the day I was born, the day I die, and the day I rise again." Which is obvious meaning that John the Baptist did die. So you can see the context there. It's the same context. It's an internal contradiction, obviously, because it contradicts Surah 4, 157, which is the classic ayah that talks about the death, the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. The fact that Jesus Christ did not die, someone else took his place. That's in Surah 4, 157. So you can see there's a tension there. And to alleviate that tension, they just mistranslate. So if you want to have a good translation, go to Arbery. Arbery. That's the best translation. It does to the Arabic what the NASB does to the Greek and the Hebrew. It's literal translation. It can be sometimes difficult to read because of that, but at least you know what you're reading is what's in the text. Rodman is also good. Rodman. Rodman and Arbery. And pretty much if you go to a good bookstore in Britain, that's the only ones you'll see on the shelves. They don't ever sell Yusuf Ali or Pictal or at least I'm not aware of any good bookstore selling Pictal. They refuse to sell them. But the Muslims will use them, all right? So whenever I'm down at Speaker's Corner or whenever I'm on campus, I will use Yusuf Ali because that's what they expect and that's what they're used to. But when I'm doing my own study at home, then I use Arbery, all right? Okay, let's get right into it. My name is Jay Smith. Some of you were here yesterday, so you know my background. I won't do that again. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to look at the Quran, and here's a Quran here. It's about the size of our New Testament, about 5,000 verses. And Amy did a pretty good job of explaining what the Quran is, how it's put together. You have basically two great divisions in the Quran. You have the Meccan surahs and the Medinan surahs. And if you just take the Quran and divide it in half, you pretty much, rule of thumb, can pretty much get the Meccan and Medinan surahs. It's roughly anywhere from the first 19 to 20 surahs, the first 19 to 20 books would be your Medinan surahs, and then from 20 or 21 all the way to 114 would be the second half, which would be your Meccan surahs. And the big difference between those, as Amy said, is the Meccan surahs are much shorter. That's why you have so many more numbers in there, and the Medinan are much longer. But content-wise, there's a huge difference. Enormous amount of difference. The Meccan surahs, when you read them, there's lots of stories about people that we know, a lot of the prophets, Abraham, Moses, Dauda, Yahya, John the Baptist, Isa, Jesus. we would recognize many of the characters, but we would not recognize the stories. The stories are quite different, and I'll say why that is and where we're, what the reason we're looking at that for the first time. The Medinan accounts, which are the first part, though they're the first part of the Quran, they are then revealed to the Prophet later, from 622 to 632, the last 10 years of his life, much longer, and they deal more with his life and what's happening in Medina. And so therefore, you get a lot more references to situations that are going on in during his life, primarily the situations with the battles, the Battle of Badr, the Battle of Uhud, the Battle of the Trenches in 624, 625, and 627. And it's these battles and the repercussions that come out. Some of the difficulties he's having with his wives are there. And so therefore, much of the material in Medina would refer to what was happening in Medina. And so what scholars are trying to say today is that really belongs in the 7th century. It's not relevant for today. Let's go back to the Meccan surahs, which are much more universalistic in content. They deal with who God is, who we are, what our responsibility is before God, the obedience, the submission we are to give God. That's relevant for the 21st century, the 20th century. Let's only use those surahs. Men like Fazlur Rahman made that statement. And he had to leave Pakistan and live the rest of his life in Chicago for making a simple statement like that. But that's a tension that's happening within Muslim circles today as to what part of the Quran they're going to now look at as or see as universal. You can see it's a debate that we also have with the Old and New Testament, but much more dynamic because it's definitely not over a period of 1,500 years they're talking about. They're talking about a period of only 22 to 23 years. Now, what I like to do when I'm with my Muslim friends is I like to ask them or find out what their claims are for the Quran. Ask them, and do that with your friends. Ask them to tell you why is it they consider this to be the Word of God. What are the claims they make? And who's had this conversation with Muslims before? Anybody here? What do they say about their Quran?
That it's perfect.
Okay, it's perfect. All right. How? In what way?
If you could only read it in its original language, it would be quite unlike any other book. It's just excellent quality.
Beautiful Arabic. It's poetic. All right. That's true. What else? It's his miracle, which would follow on from what Peter is saying, because if it's perfect, how could a man write something so beautiful? How could a man write something that is so poetic? A man who's illiterate, doesn't write, he couldn't write, could he come up with something like this? And that's the one miracle they're looking for, because there's no other miracle that Muhammad refers to. In fact, when asked that question in the Quran three times, he says, why is it you asked me to show you a miracle? All the prophets before me did miracles. You didn't believe them. Why should I expect you to believe me? Not much of a defense. But that's, therefore, the only miracle they can come up with is the Quran itself. All right, what else do they claim about the Quran? It's perfect as far as its poetry. What else? Okay, no contradictions. Yeah, there are no contradictions. Anything else? No errors, which would go along with the contradictions. All right. And the word they like to give, and I hear it all the time, is it is inimitable. They love that word. It is inimitable. It has no weaknesses. So it is perfect in its grammar. It's perfect in its Arabic. And we talked about that a little bit last night. It has no contradiction. It has no errors. Let them say this and pull them out and hear what they're doing with the Quran. And then once they have said these things, then start looking at each one of these areas. And that's what we're going to do real quickly right now. Let's look at some of the claims they make. It's unique. The hadith, Mishkat al-Masabi. Mishkat al-Masabi is a compilation of the six most authoritative hadith. Hadith would be the sayings of the Prophet. We'll get into that a little bit later. And this is what it says. The Quran is the greatest wonder among the wonders of the world. I'm reading the paper you have in front of you. If you don't have a copy, come on down here. There are copies if you're arguing. The Quran is the greatest wonder among the wonders of the world. This book is second to none in the world according to the unanimous decision of the learned men in points of diction, style, rhetoric, thoughts, and soundness of law and regulations to shape the destinies of mankind. Therefore, bring a chapter like unto it is a common claim. And this comes from Surah 10, Ayah 37 to 38, and also from Surah 2, Ayah 23, Surah 17, 88. Usually whenever I'm having a debate with Muslims, this is usually the last thing they come up. This is if they bring this claim, I pretty much know that they don't have any other ammo. They're on their last legs. They usually go to this as a last gasp. Reference. Because in the Quran it does say there's nothing that can equal it. Now, has anybody had a Muslim do this to them? What we call the surah like it argument. If that happens, open up the Bible. This is what I love to do. I was at Trafalgar Square. Every year they have a rally for Islam at Trafalgar Square, the Mahajirun do. And Sheikh Omar Bakri Muhammad asked me to come down to do a debate with him there. And we did. We've had two debates there at the Trafalgar Square in August, back about two or three years ago. And we got up there and we had a debate on the Quran. And this was his last gasp effort. He finally turned to me and said, Mr. Smith, produce a surah like it. Produce anything that is of equal beauty. And so I took out my Bible. I took out this one right here. And I opened up to Psalm 23, and I just started reading it very clearly and very slowly, Psalm 23. And they turned off the mic. They didn't want me to repeat it. Then I turned to him, and I says, now you produce a surah like that. Show me anything in the Quran that can equal that. In any language. I did it in English. You can do it in Arabic if you want to. There's nothing in the Quran that equals what I find in Psalm. Do that and see what happens. Usually I've never heard yet a Muslim rebut that. They may at the most say, well, it must be in Arabic. I say, fine, read Psalm 23 in Arabic. And what it does, and I think we need to start doing this, it usually nips that whole argument in the bud. Because Muslims are not expecting you to come up with a response. And since they've given us the challenge, respond with a counter challenge. Go back and read the Bible. Take whatever is your favorite passage. I like Psalm 23. You may like Psalm 2 or Psalm 1 or 1 Corinthians 13. Whatever is your favorite passage, read it and then use it to say, now, let me tell you why it's beautiful. Let me tell you what is it that I get out of it. Let me show you what God's saying in this word. Immediately, you're elevating the Bible where it belongs. But you're also, basically, you're saying, anybody can make this claim. Because really, they aren't expecting a response. And it's amazing the reaction we're getting from Muslims when we do this. Because what they will try to say, well, actually, it cannot be equal because of the poetry, the style. I say, fine, look at the poetry that we see in Psalms. But they don't know how to define that poetry. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that poetry later on. It's superior in literary style. Yet it's full of disjunction, repetitive. If any of you read the Quran, how many people have tried to read the Quran here? Okay, what has been your experience when you try to read it? Okay. All right. Go ahead. What's your experience?
Amen.
All right. Any other experience? Go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. What has been your experience, Peter?
I was reading through some of the Meccan surahs slowly in Arabic, and yeah, they're not really exciting. They don't seem to be about very much.
Okay. They don't end, do they?
No.
And many times they don't begin. They meander all over the place. If you look at Surah 2, that's probably the best one. The cow. I mean, you start off with one story that jumps all the way back to David, then jumps forward to Yahya, and there's no chronology, there's no transitional phrases to help you to go from story to story. It assumes you know the stories already, which is interesting. But there is no reason or rhyme to any of the way it's put together. And because of that, it is very disjunctive. It's full of repetition. God is merciful, God is compassionate, over and over again. And even the stories contradict each other. We'll get to that a little later. These are some, if you look at A, B, C, D, E, F, G, these are some comparisons that you can do if you want to. Compare different surahs with different biblical passages. We use these all the time at Speaker's Corner when we like to show like with like. And we have found that Muslims are not aware of the fact that there is lots of literature, but I like to just use the Bible if I can, since that's the one I'm trying to support anyhow. Just showing how the Bible, when put against the Quran, when you're dealing with idea, is superior in every case. If you feel you want to get into this kind of discussion with your Muslim friend, use these if you want to, and certainly see what happens. You can see the one number F there for you, Becky, Surah 2, and I, Surah 4. That's women's issues, and just compare that with Ephesians 5. That's a great comparison. But let's hear what the Orientalists, those who have spent their life, their career studying the Quran, let's see what they say about the Quran. And these are Europeans. Theodor Noldecke, who is German, he finds that the Quran is chaotic, confusion, prosaic, stiff in style, tedious sermonizing, rhetorical, never metrical, and the rhyme on the whole a burdensome yoke, superfluous verbiage, syntax, betrays great awkwardness, tiresome effect of its endless iterations, so that dogma turns what he calls a defective literary production into an unrivaled masterpiece in the eyes of the believers. Salman Reinach, another German scholar, says from the literary point of view, the Quran has little merit. Declamation, repetition, puerility, a lack of logic and coherence strike the unprepared reader at every turn. It is humiliating to the human intellect to think that this mediocre literature has been the subject of innumerable commentaries and that millions of men are still wasting time in absorbing it. Now be careful. Don't read this to your Muslim friend. That's just for you to know. Obviously, not everybody agrees that it is perfect and beautiful. and those who have spent their life are studying it from outside the Islam, obviously. But I think what we do see, and I tell my Muslim friends, that maybe some of the beauty that they see may have an awful lot to do with familiarity. I find Handel's Messiah beautiful whenever I hear it, and it brings tears to my eyes. But I'm sure they don't. And it has an awful lot of that to do with the fact that I've grown up with Handel's Messiah. And when I hear it, it does ring, gives me a sense of, not only a sense of beauty, not only a sense of awe, but it feels like I'm going home again. And I remember having grown up in Muslim lands and having been in, having heard the Quran recited most of my life, it is beautiful. I find I miss it sometimes when I don't hear it. And it has a beautiful cadence to it, and it's gorgeous when you hear it again, if you've been away for a long time. But I think we need to be careful we don't confuse that with some sort of divine beauty. I'm going to skip over the grammatical purity, because Muslims do believe it's grammatically correct, but unless you know Arabic, unless you really, really understand how to discuss or debate this area, I wouldn't even get into it. Don't you do it. Let those who know Arabic debate these issues. Go ahead.
One word about vowels.
Yeah.
The Sabirin and Sabirun, I mean, I just immediately thought that I thought the vowels don't, not that they don't matter, but that they weren't there originally.
No, they weren't there, you're right. And it's what we're talking about is the present-day Quran. This is the day with the vowelizations, because the diacritical marks would have been added somewhere around the late 7th, early 8th century, and the vowelization would have been canonized around the late 8th century. So the text that we have in our hand today, the Kyrene text, this is the text that you'll find here. This is the text that was canonized in 1924 of all time. I mean, most Muslims aren't even aware of that. Their canonized Quran that we have in our hand today is only 100, less than 100 years old. That text is vowelized. And so that's why it's this text that we're talking about. I'm talking about right now, this is the internal critique. I should maybe have said at the very beginning. We're looking at this Quran here, okay? We're going to talk then about earlier manuscripts in the second section of this talk. But yeah, these are to do with the Quran that you'll have in your hand today. These are the grammatical difficulties. They say it's also a universal text. Now, here's somewhere where you can get into discussions with them. What we use this all the time with students down at Speaker's Corner. I will get up on the ladder and I'll put the Bible in one hand, I'll put the Quran in the other hand, and I'll say, listen, they both claim to be the Word of God. How are we going to come to some conclusion? Because they contradict each other. God does not contradict himself. Which one is the true Word of God? And that immediately gets a crowd. You're going to get a big crowd when you make claims like that. Not just Muslims. A lot of Muslims will come to hear, but even those who are not. And we find that once we start talking about the content that's in there, we start looking at some of the verses that are in there. We talk about the problems with women, women's issues, what you do with Surah 434, or what you do with certainly the image of heaven, and what in Surah 55, in Surah 56, or the fact that women are given half the inheritance of a man, only half the vote of a man. If that is the context for a 7th century environment, is it relevant for the 21st century? Therefore, is it a universal text that is relevant for today? And one of the most common themes that we seem to be coming with all the time post 9/11 is the problem of violence. What are you going to do with the one, two, or three verses that are peaceful? Surah 2, 193 is one of them. Surah 5, Ayah 35 is another. Ayah 32 is another, which talks about, actually, it's a story of Cain and Abel. Cain having killed Abel, looking for means to do what to do with the body. He sees a raven scratching in the ground, so he then buries his brother like the raven has. And then the next verse, Ayah 32, says, "For he who sheds the blood of one man, it's as if he sheds the blood of all men. And he who saves the blood of one, it's as if he saves the blood of all." And many Muslims have used that to show that if you kill one person, it's as if you killed everybody. And they claim that that's a peace verse. Ironically, the radical Muslims use that same verse to stipulate that if you kill one Muslim, you've killed me. If you kill the blood of one Muslim, you've taken the blood of all Muslims. And they use that as a rallying cry for jihad. And Sheikh Omar Makli uses that all the time in London to support his need to get to galvanize people to leave and go to places like Al-Qaeda, which they have sent upwards of 2,000 now to go join. That was long before 9/11, 2001. Then probably the most famous verse is Surah 2, Ayah 256, "For there is no compulsion in religion." And this is the verse that most Muslims like to quote. What they don't tell you is that Surah 2 and Surah 2, Ayah 256, Surah 2, Ayah 193, and Surah 5, Ayah 32, all three of these surahs are Meccan surahs, except for 256. It was revealed to the Prophet supposedly between 622 and 624. So it's an early Medinan verse. while Muhammad was trying to ally himself with the Jews living in Medina. Now you can understand why this verse would be revealed to him at that time. He didn't want to have any compulsion, didn't want to force the Jews to accept him, because he wanted their alliance. That was broken then in 624, and from that time on, then, the verses start to change. And what you will find is that from there on out, almost all the Medinan verses get very violent, and you can even see an evolution in the violence up until Surah 9, which is the last surah to have been revealed to the Prophet when he was in 632. The Surah 9 is full of violence. Slay the unbeliever wherever ye find them. Besiege them with every kind of warfare. Lay ambush for them. That's Surah 9, Ayah 5. Surah 9, Ayah 29, which is just a few verses down, talks about the Christians and says, O ye who are people of the book, make war on the people of the book until they pay the zakat and do the salat, the prayers. So you can see that there's an awful lot of violence that comes much later. In Surah 16, Ayah 101, in Surah 2, Ayah 106, you have what we call the law of abrogation, which stipulates that that which we give something better. So if there's two verses that contradict each other, you always go with the latter verse. If there's a Meccan verse that is contradicted by a Medinan verse, you always go with the Medinan verses. So if you have any peace verses that may exist, and there's very few of them that exist in Meccan surahs, any Medinan verses obviously abrogate that. So Surah 2, Ayah 256, we have found over 101 verses that abrogate it, including Surah 9:5. Now, Muslims aren't telling you this unless you're talking to men like Sheikh Omar Bakri or Anjam Chowdhury or some of the more radical Muslims in Britain. They're the ones that are coming up with these verses, and they're the ones that are saying, listen, you've got to exegete the scriptures correctly. When you exegete them correctly, you always go with the latter verse. The latter verse is the most authoritative. And the same thing works with scripture. They take that same idea and say, therefore, if there's any contradiction between two scriptures, including the New Testament, you always go with the latter. So therefore, if the Quran contradicts the New Testament on the crucifixion of Jesus, you always go with Surah 4, 157, rather than the four Gospels, using the same paradigm. Can you understand then why it's so important to them that they do exegete it correctly? Now, can you then understand that this is a good discussion for you to get into as Christians? We need to ask and say, hold on a minute, is that how we look at literature? Is that how we look at historical perspective? Is that how we live today? I mean, when you have an accident out in the street, who do you go to? Second, third, and fourth eyewitnesses, or you go to the eyewitness itself? No. You don't go to the second, third, fourth witness, or someone who's heard it through the oral grapevine. You go to the person who was right there on the scene. That's why we have the signs always whenever an accident happens, asking people who are eyewitnesses to phone up the police. And the same thing actually works within Islam, and we'll get into that when we talk about Isnad later on. So certainly these are perfectly okay, these are perfectly good themes for you to talk on when you talk about the universal qualities. Is it universal? Is it relevant for today, especially vis-a-vis these sword verses? Over 101 sword verses that we can count there in the Medinan surahs. Collation. We don't have too much time to get into that one today. Basically, just as a quick overview, when you want to know how the Quran was put together, most Muslims are not aware. Let me just back that up. Most Muslims have not read the Quran themselves. Certainly those living in the West have not read it, for one very good reason. You do not read the Quran like we read the Bible. We have Bible studies. Any of us can open it up in any language, any of our mother tongues, and we can pretty well understand it. You've already said that you had a hard time understanding this book. And that's it's understandable. A good 20% of the Quran nobody can understand. Not even the Islamic scholars can understand a good 20% of it. It just does not make any sense. But you don't go to the Quran, therefore, to understand it. If you are going to read the Quran, you're going to do it to memorize it. So when they say that they have read the Quran, what they're saying is they've memorized the Quran, and almost invariably in Arabic. But remember, only 17% of the world understands Arabic. The vast majority of Muslims you come across, certainly in Europe, do not read or understand Arabic. Though they may have memorized it in Arabic, they will not know what they've memorized. I have a good friend in London. His name is Ishmael. He is a Hafiz. That means he's memorized the entire Quran by heart. And I ask him, just as a game, I say, okay, come on, Ishmael, tell me Surah 2, Ayah 145. And he stops and thinks a while, and then goes, perfect, exactly word for word. I say, okay, now tell me what you've just said. Oh, Mr. Smith, don't ask me to translate. I have no idea what I said. This man has memorized the entire Quran about the size of our New Testament, and he may understand a few words of it, but he has no idea what he's memorized. It's as if I'd asked any of you to memorize the entire New Testament in Greek. Would you do so? Why? What's the purpose? Well, obviously the purpose is to gain barakah, to gain blessing to that angel that's on their right shoulder, that's recording all their good deeds here. enormous amount of barakah when you have memorized. And of course, you become highly respected in your community. You usually are given the privilege of leading the prayers if you are a hafiz. But nothing more. So they do not go to their Quran to read it, to understand it. You may know more about the Quran just from this session here than what they will when you get out. Now be aware of that. So many times they will question what you're saying. And that's why it's very important that if you do take a Quran, make sure it's in English or in Italian, wherever you're living, so that you can point to it and say, listen, I'm not making this up. It is actually there. Read it for yourself. And you'll probably be doing them a great favor. They need to realize what the Quran is saying. Most of them have no idea what the Quran is saying. There's a huge ignorance. And the same way concerns how it was put together. They have no idea how it was put together. So what I usually tell my Muslim friends is to go back and read how Bukhari tells it was put together. Now, Bukhari is a compiler. Bukhari was a character who lived in the 9th century, who compiled the Quran. I'm sorry, not sorry. Who compiled what we know as the Hadith, the most authoritative compilations of part of the Islamic traditions called the Hadith, the sayings of the Prophet. He is considered to be the highest authority after the Quran. After the Quran comes the Hadith. And we'll talk about the Hadith and the Sira and the Tafsir and the Tariq in a short while. But the Hadith compiled by Bukhari are to be trusted. There is no error, according to Muslims today, there is no error in Bukhari, except if you're Shiite. The Shiites do not like Bukhari. But the Sunnis, who make up 90% of the Muslim world, look to Bukhari as the authority. And the reason why is that since the Quran does not make any sense, since there's not much in the Quran that actually helps you to live today, you need to go to the Hadith to find out how you're to live. All right? You need to go to the Sira to find out how Muhammad lived. You need to go to the Tafsir, which would be the commentaries, to know how to interpret the Quran. And you need to go to the Tahriq, which would be the histories, to understand the history behind the Quran and how it was put together. But certainly, it's Bukhari that you go to find out how the Quran was collated. And when you go to Bukhari, you find some very disturbing material. Now, in order for you to know what Bukhari says, you need to go up on the internet. All of Bukhari's volumes are up there. You can pull them down. Northampton University, Cambridge University, any of the larger universities in Britain have the ISOCs, the Islamic societies, have put up Bukhari there. However, recently, since we've been getting into this debate, I've noticed that a lot of the Muslims are now pulling out these problem passages. Such as Bukhari, volume 6. Probably the best one to go to is Bukhari, volume 6, hadith number 509 and 510. Go and read what it says. And he says, I'll just paraphrase it here. Basically what Bukhari says is, when Muhammad died, the Quran had not been written down. But it had been memorized by many of the companions. It had been written down on pieces of bone, stone, sometimes bark. So that Zayd ibn Thabit, who is the scribe, the secretary of Muhammad, was given the responsibility by Abu Bakr, the first caliph, around 632 to 634, to compile it, to write the first recension of the Quran, which he did by going here, there, and yon, getting it from the different numbers of the companions, those who had not been killed at the Battle of Yamama. That first recension then, which is the Quran, supposedly the perfect Quran, was then given to one of the wives of Muhammad named Hafsa. She put it under her bed and left it there for about 20 years. Roughly 20 years later, around 650, let's put up a timeline so you can see where I'm going. Around 650 then. Okay, so this happened right around this time. He died in 632. So around this period is the first recension. That is with Abu Bakr, the first caliph. Around this time period, 650 then, Uthman, the third caliph, was approached by Hudhayfa. Hudhayfa says, listen, what are we going to do? Because there are different recensions. There are different recitations of the Quran. We need to do something about this. We need to write it so people know what is the correct recitation. So Uthman then has Zayd ibn Thabit, who is from Medina, the secretary of Muhammad, along with three other men, Alas, Zubair, and Harith, the four of them, take Hafsa's copy, which is laying under the bed, took her copy, and rewrote it. Now stop and think. Why would you need to rewrite something that's perfect? All right. Beyond that, it says that Uthman championed the four of them and said, if you have any problem, if you have any doubt as to what you're to rewrite, now stop and think, why would they have any doubt if it's perfect and complete? Then you are to take it and you are to go to the Quraishi dialect and rewrite that which is in the Quraishi dialect. Now, right away, you can see there are going to be problems because in order to have a dialect, help me out here, Peter, how is it that you delineate one dialect in a written context, written Arabic text from another dialect?
Well, it's difficult because it's mainly vowels.
Exactly. So, therefore, you have to have vowelizations to know that one dialect is different. Were there any vowelizations in the 7th century? You got a problem here. How is it that they could even delineate one certainly one dialect from another dialect? But you've got to remember who's stating this. This is Buhari telling us this. Buhari died in 870. This is the 9th century Buhari who's telling us that this must have been happening in the 7th century. He didn't know his own history. You can see there's some real problems what he's saying here. And the reason why is because if you're going to have any dialectic differences, the dialectic difference would have probably happened quite a bit later than that, because dialects form, Arabic dialects form, if there's usually a liaison with another language. And what we do know that there were four codices, four metropolitan codices that existed at this time. There were many others on top of that, another 11 on top of that. But the four major codices, one was Ubay ibn Kabs, which was very popular in Damascus. The other was Ibn Mas'ud, which is very popular in Baghdad, and then Ibn Musa, very popular in Basra, and then Zayd ibn Thabit, which is very popular in Medina. The difficulty is there was differences between these codices. Now, Muslims today are trying to say these were dialectic differences. The difficulty with that, we're talking about 650. These cities were only conquered 10 years earlier. Basra and Baghdad were conquered, actually, in 638. Damascus was conquered in 640, 641. So you can see if there's going to be any dialectic differences, how do you have dialects forming within 10 years? If you have in Damascus, you would have the Greek imposing itself on the Arabic. You could see a dialect forming maybe within 100 years, but not in 10 years. The same if you have in Basra and Baghdad, you have the Pahlavi interjecting and imposing itself on the Arabic. A dialect would have formed out of that, but not within just 9 years. Possibly 100 to 150 years, yes. And certainly at the time of Buhari, there would have been dialectic differences. By that time, 250 years later, yes, you would have seen dialectic differences. So if there are different schools of manuscripts that existed which had different dialectic differences, because vowelization would have been included at that time, you would have not only noticed the dialectic differences, you would have had dialects that would have been different. So you can see right away that Orientalists today are now looking at this, saying this may tell us more about what was happening in the 9th century than what was happening in the 7th century. But what we do know, and this is a work that has been done by a man named Arthur Jeffrey in the 1940s, went and looked at all the traditions. He looked at all the hadith, the compilation, the six great compilations, Buhari, Tirmidhi, Ibn Daud. He looked at those great compilations, and he, just by delineating what they've said, he came up with 16 different codices, reference to 16 different codices that existed at the time of Uthman. Four metropolitan codices, which are the most important, all of which disagreed, and he came up with over 15,000 differences between the 16 codices. That's a lot of differences. You can see right now, no wonder the Muslims don't want us to read al-Bukhari, and why they're now starting to excise off the internet these volumes. But you can go to any good bookstore. Al-Huda in London has all of 9 volumes of al-Bukhari. You can go get it. You can also get the CD-ROM, the Alim. The CD-ROM has all of al-Bukhari on the CD-ROM, which is great. And we take these down and we let the Muslims read it for themselves. And you can see their anger when they're told what Bukhari is saying. They have no idea that Bukhari is saying this about their own text and how the Quran is put together. The claims Muslims are making today, Bukhari would have never claimed. The 9th and 10th century scholars never made these claims about the Quran. They were well aware of the fact that there were many codices that they didn't agree. And then it says in Hadith number 510 of volume 6, it then ends that once Zayd ibn Thabit, Alas, Zubair, and Harith had compiled this final recension, this second recension out of Hafsa's copy, once they had done that, Uthman then burned all the other manuscripts. Why would you burn manuscripts unless they didn't agree? Can you see the difficulty with that? Now that's right there in Buhari. You can understand then why there's a difficulty with this when you get into discussion with Muslims. Let's go on to the internal contradictions. Muslims will tell you that there are no contradictions in the Quran. We've come up with over 220 contradictions in the Quran. If you want to go up online and get my paper, I've got about 50 to 55 that we like to use at Speaker's Corner. They're the ones that we field tested. If they have asterisks before, they're the best ones to use. These are just about 10 or 11 or 12 of them you can use. Be careful with contradictions. You can waste an awful long time, a lot of time with them. I don't like to get into contradictions anymore because they're not that important to me. And what will usually happen is Muslims say, well, you've got just as many contradictions in the Bible, and it becomes tit for tat. And because of that, I usually try to stay away from contradictions if I can help it. If they make up the claim that we have contradictions, usually what I do is I just give them a copy of our paper. We have Shabir Ali and his organization came up with a paper called 101 Clear Contradictions of the Bible. And we went, took every one of those 101 contradictions, came up with answers for every one of them. And then we put up another paper called 101 Cleared Up Contradictions of the Bible. It's up on the internet. Just give them that. And they'll pretty much take care of it so you don't have to memorize all of them. They're all there. And these are all the classical contradictions. They're there whether you like it or not, whether you agree with them, read it, give it to them, and then say, here, this should clear it up for you. Let's move on to something that's a little more substantial. The errors are probably the better ones to use because these ones get right into some real difficulties with the claim that it's inimitable. We found a good number of what we call historical anachronisms and certainly scientific errors. Let me just go through a number of them with you here. In Surah 7 and also in Surah 12, the story of Moses and Pharaoh, Moses goes and does, in Surah 7, he starts performing his different signs or the different plagues, as we call it, the different signs, as they call it in the Quran. And the Pharaoh's sorcerers are supposed to try to keep up with him, but they can't. So therefore, the Pharaoh goes and crucifies one of the sorcerers. That happens as we know, Moses would have lived in about 1400 B.C. In the story of Joseph in Surah 12, the only complete story in the Quran, it's the only one that begins, continues, and ends. In Ayah 41, the baker who's in prison with Joseph is brought out of the prison and is crucified. Now the question we ask is, we don't know of any crucifixion at all. There's no documentation of any crucifixion except in the 6th century. The first reference to any crucifixion is with Darius in 519 B.C. So how is it you're having crucifixion in 1400 B.C. and crucifixions in 1800 B.C.? A historical anachronism. And many Muslims have tried to get out of that. And one of the ones that I love, they usually say, there are crosses in Egypt to show that Moses, at the time of Moses, there was crucifixion. And it's called the Ankh. Have any of you seen an Ankh? How large is an Ankh? It's usually about that big, though. It's usually worn around your neck, isn't it? And what is it for? What is it to? It's a fertility symbol, yeah. It's just the opposite of death. I don't recall anybody being crucified on one of them. But certainly, Muslims will try to come up with you with a comeback on that one. In Surah 19, Ayah 7, it mentions that Yahya, which is the name for John the Baptist, is a unique name, and that he was the first to ever be given this name. Yet we have quite a few references to John prior to that. 2 Kings 25, 23 is probably the earliest. One of the more classic errors that is found is the story of Mary, the mother of Jesus. Mary is referred to, Jesus is referred to as the son of Mary over and over and over again, primarily as a polemic against Christianity to show that he came from a woman and was not the son of God. But the same Mary is the sister of Aaron and also the daughter of Imran. Now we know that Imran is the same as Amran, and Aaron would have had a sister named Miriam. I also had a brother named Moses, but they didn't live at the time of Jesus. That Miriam lived at 1400 B.C., you can see they got a confusion with the Amran of the Old Testament, whose son was Aaron, whose brother was Moses, whose sister was Miriam. The Miriam of the Old Testament seemed to be confused with the Mary, the mother of Jesus. You've got 1,400 years between them. In Surah 20, and also, Surah 20, you have a Samaritan building the golden calf. Yet the Samaritans only came into existence once Sennacherib, his son, took and destroyed the tribe. I'm sorry, it was Sargon II, destroyed the 10 northern tribes, took them into captivity to Assyria. And of course, those people that he left behind and to populate the cities who intermarried with the Jews who were left behind became the Samaritans. Now that happened in the 6th and 7th century. You couldn't have had that happening, obviously, the 8th century. That wouldn't have been in existence at the time of Moses. So you've got a real difficulty there in that anachronism. Muslims who I've questioned about this have tried to say, actually it's not the word Samaritan, it's Samadi, which means traveler. Now I've heard that reference to it. The difficulty with that is the word Samadi in this case is not referring to, it's the only place that we see it referred to. There are other words. Al-Samidi is found, Ibn Sabili is the traveler, the son of the road, Ibn Sabili in Surah 7:122. And I'm getting mixed up with Sabili and Samadi. You can't really confuse the two because they have the different consonants. And here you can help me with this one, Peter. Peter pointed this one out to me yesterday, number 5, where you have Haman. who is considered to be an Egyptian who builds a tower to God. Now, we know that there wasn't really an Egyptian to build a tower to God. We know that Nimrod is probably credited with that story. But the problem is the name itself. And Peter helped me here. It should not be Babylonian. You're saying it probably is more Persian.
Yeah, I haven't checked that. But Babylonian doesn't have an H.
That's... And also, if it comes from Xerxes' court, it would have to be Persian. Because Mordecai and Esther were in Xerxes' court, who is a Persian king. So that changed that to Persian, not Babylonian. But obviously the problem here is you have something, a tower that was built 750 years earlier than what they're saying it. And of course they've got the wrong story with the wrong character in the wrong city, in the wrong country. Alexander the Great, Dhul-Qarnayn is the name that is given to Alexander the Great in Arabic, Dhul-Qarnayn. And according to the Quran, Dhul-Qarnayn in Surah 18 builds this great wall of iron and brass between two mountains large enough to keep an entire army out. Now, we know quite a bit about Alexander the Great. He lived in the 4th century BC. There's been three biographies of his life. No one has ever heard of any recording of him building a wall that large of iron and brass that could keep an army out. It would be one of the greatest engineering feats in the world, in the history of mankind. Fascinating that none of us have heard about it. One I love to do, and they used to always throw this at me at Speaker's Corner, they would say that the mountains were placed on earth by God, by Allah, to keep the earth from shaking. And the... Obviously, mountains are large, they are heavy. It stands to reason, if you're pre-scientific, that that would probably be a pretty good conclusion, and there's always a lot of shaking around where mountains are. If any of you have grown up in mountains, I grew up in the Himalayas, was born there, and of course we had landslides all the time, earthquakes all the time, because the Himalaya mountains are growing. They are still a very young mountain. They grow about as fast as a fingernail every year. That's not too fast, but certainly they are growing. But why are they growing? Anybody know? What is happening with mountain ranges? Tectonic plates colliding. That's right. It's the collision of two tectonic plates. You have the Indian plate colliding against the Tibetan plateau, the Tibetan plate, which is creating the Himalaya mountains as we have today. And this happens all over the world with mountain ranges. Many mountain ranges, most mountain ranges, are a result of the earth tectonic plates colliding, causing a wrinkle in the earth's crust, which, ironically, is the result of shaking, not eradicating shaking. It actually causes the shaking, just the opposite of what the Quran's saying. But then you can understand, if you're pre-scientific, how you'd come to this conclusion. I won't go to number 8, because that has to do with my family. If I were to die, my widow would have, according to Surah 4, 1, 11 and 12, my wife would have 1/8 of an inheritance. This is my sister when she lost her husband. She would have had 1/8. Her three daughters would have had 2/3 of the inheritance, and because she had two surviving parents, they would have had 1/3, which it comes up to 112%. If I died, my mother would get 1/3, my wife would get 1/3, my two sisters would get 2/3, which is 133%. Whoever wrote the Quran didn't have good math. Let's go to number 10, because we're short of time. And this one really puts us right into the next area. And this is the dirham argument. It's also in the same story of Joseph. You have Joseph being sold to the Egyptians for a few dirham counted out. Now, most people read right past that and don't think anything above it. But when I read that, I suddenly said, hold on a minute, stop and think. Dirham counted out suggests coins, right? You count out coins. Was Joseph sold for coins at all? And the answer is no, because back in the time of Joseph's period, in 1800 BC, there were no coins. Coins were not invented until the 7th century. So obviously you've got a problem there. So what's going on? Well, maybe let's see if the Bible has this problem. Let's go back to, and if you turn the page, you can see, go back to Genesis 37:28, which speaks about the same story. There you see that Joseph is sold for 20 shekels. Is shekels a coin? No. What is shekels? Anybody know what a shekels is? It's a weighted measure. And 20 shekels is about 0.2% of a kilo of silver. It's a weighted measure. And the shekels were introduced by the Babylonians in the 3rd millennia. So you can see that the Bible at least has the right currency. It's got a bullion weight. It doesn't have a coin. So at least the Bible is correct in that point. What is interesting is when you come back to dirham, you might say, well, hypothetically, maybe Muhammad was receiving a revelation about a coin that was in existence at the time Muhammad was living. Therefore, he was trying to contextualize it for the people, the readers at that time. Maybe that's all that's going on. So Muhammad was receiving a revelation of the dirham that existed at his time. And let's go with that. Let's say that maybe that's what's happening here. You're willing to go with that, aren't you, Peter?
Well, the Living Bible, one of the editions for the parable of the Good Samaritan has the guy giving the innkeeper £2 notes.
That's how we contextualize it for today. So maybe that was going on. So the dirham is what is referred to there. Were there any dirhams at the time of Muhammad? Now here's the problem. When was the dirham created?
It died out.
There were no dirhams at all. There were drachmas. So when did the dirham appear? The dirham appeared in 642. The dirham is an Arab coin that was invented and created by Umar the First as a replacement for the drachma. But it only appeared on the world stage in 642, 10 years after Muhammad's death. So how does Muhammad receive a revelation for a coin that was yet to appear for another 10 years? It's as if I were to sell your watch that you have there, Peter, back in 1960 for 20 euros. Back in 1960, no one would know what we're talking about. But today we know what a euro is. Can you see the problem? How could Muhammad have even known about a coin that was yet to be invented? So what does that suggest to you? He's a prophet. And that's what everybody tells me. Proof of his prophethood. What does it really suggest to you? Probably this was written later. And that moves us into the historical context. And let's now, what we're going to do is we're going to now go right into that. And we're going to look and see if that may be the problem here. And to do that, we need to ask, what is it we know about Islam? Now, how many of you were here on Sunday when Amy did that great overview of what Islam believes? Okay, did you remember the history she gave us, the history lesson she gave us of Muhammad's life? Like in 5 minutes, but it's a very quick history lesson. I'll just put the timeline real quickly. Basically, she said, if we look at his birth in 570, he started receiving his revelations in 610, had that little test with his wife, Khadija, when he came back from the Hira cave. She put him on one leg and asked him the same question twice, then took off all her clothes and asked it a third time, and each time he said, yes, it was an angel, she knew he was telling the truth. Great test, glad my wife doesn't give it to me. Then he moved up from Mecca to Medina in 622, about 12 years later, with around 200 of his followers. Tried to make an alliance between the Ansar and the Jews that were there. That was maintained until about 624, when he then had a falling out with the Jews, primarily because they would not accept him as a prophet, for obvious reasons, for four very good reasons, which I don't have time to get into right now. From 624, you have the great battle of Badr, when he 300 men, he defeated over 1,000. And he came back claiming that God had given him victory, and this gave an enormous amount of authority. He then created the Khilafah. The Khilafah had been created in 620, but really the real time for the Khilafah would have been around 624 when it was announced. At the same time, he had a great, what they call, night of power journey on the back of the winged horse called the Burak from Surah 17:1 speaks about it, from the great mosque to the farthest mosque, from Mecca up to Jerusalem, and then up to the seven heavens to meet with God, where he was received, that he was to pray 50 times a day, came down to heavens, talked to Moses. Moses says, that's too many, go up and see if you can get it down. So he goes back and forth between Moses and God, or Allah, and brings it down to five prayers. Comes back on the winged horse, and that all happens in 624. 630, he finally goes into Mecca without firing a shot, and then 2 years later, he dies. Now, all that story that Amy talked to us about, where do you think it comes from? The Hadith, okay. Where else? The Sirah. Siratu Rasulullah. The biography of the Prophet of God. All right? It's those two genres of literature that we go to find out the Prophet's life. Then, as I said earlier, if you want to go and find out how is it you're to interpret the Quran, you need to go to the tafsir. If you look at the page there, we've got the Sirah, Hadith, Tariq, the tafsir. But look at the dates of when these genre of literature were written down. When you go to the Hadith, let's go to the Sirah because they're the earliest. The Sirah to Rasulullah were first written down by a man named Ibn Ishaq, and his name is right here. And look when he died. He died in 765. But we don't have any of his in his material. It's all been lost. We have to go to one of his disciples named Ibn Hisham. Here's his name. Ibn Hisham is the one who wrote what Ibn Ishaq had written down, but he threw out an awful lot that he considered to be spurious. So it was really what he considered to be authoritative. He died in 833. That's 200 years after Muhammad's death. So everything we know about the life of Muhammad doesn't begin to get written down until the early 9th century, around 820 to 833, when that was written down. If you want to go to about what Muhammad had said, the Hadith, you have to go to Al-Bukhari, who's the most authoritative. He dies in 870. It's written between 850 and 870, last 20 years of his life. That's the mid-9th century. You get the Hadith first written down. After him comes Sahih Muslim, 5 years after him. Then comes Tirmidhi, then comes Ibn Dawud. All of them come post-870. All right, so late 9th century into the 10th century. If you want to talk about the tafsir and the tahriq, the first person to write down any tafsir, any tahriq, is Al-Tabari. And he died in 923, and he's writing this all down in the 10th century. Now, there's many that wrote after him, Baladuri, Zamakshari, Suyuti. They all come after Al-Tabari. So all these references to the life of Muhammad, all the stories surrounding his life, how Islam began, do not get written down until the 9th and 10th century. We don't have anything before that period. Does that bother any of you? Why does that bother you, Peter? Okay, because what is it based on? What do you think it's based on? Anybody? Where did they get all the material? Where does Bukhari, where does Ibn Hisham, where does Al-Tabi? Well, we know Ibn Hisham got it from Ibn Ishaq. But where does Ibn Ishaq, all these individuals, where do they get their material from? Why? From whom? Eyewitnesses? No. Whenever you look at any akbar of the hadith or the sirah or the tafsir, every akbar is divided into two. You have a list of names called the isnad, and you have the matan, which is the body of material, a sentence or a phrase or a paragraph. You always have the isnad followed by, or this way, isnad followed by the matan. And the isnad is a name, chain of names, saying that I got this phrase or this story from so-and-so who got it from so-and-so who got it from so-and-so who got it from the Prophet. All right? Oral tradition. Basically, what we're talking about is 200 years of oral tradition before it was finally written down, 200 years to 300 years after the fact, and hundreds of miles away from the scene, because none of these individuals are Arab. Hisham, Bukhari, Tabari, these are not Arab names. Tabari from Tabaristan, Bukhari from Bukharistan, these are places in what we call the Iran and Iraq today. These are Kufic names. These are actually not Kufic, I'm sorry, Abbasid names. These are Abbasid names from Persians who live hundreds of miles away and hundreds of years distance. Now, obviously, that's a problem for historians today. And many of the historians are looking at this saying, hold on a minute, this is written so late, in a time period when there's no reason for it to be written late, because we don't have the same problem that we have with our traditions, our early documents, because our early documents were written on papyrus. Papyrus disintegrates within about 200 years. Therefore, you do have schools of papyrus, and you do need copies made of immediately. And we have copies of copies of copies before they're finally written down. That you would expect for New Testament documentation. We're not even going to talk about the Old Testament, for New Testament documentation. But see, by the 4th century, parchment and vellum came into existence. That's why we have codices from the 4th century on. That's why you have the Sinaiticus and the Alexandrinus and the Vaticanus. The two of them, the Alexandrinus and the Sinaiticus, right there in the British Library, the Riblack Gallery. Go and see them. And they're written on gazelle skin. Those are some of the earliest codices in existence. And they're beautiful. They're pristine. And at that time, because they were written on gazelle skin, they were durable enough that you could bind them on one end, and therefore they could last for a good, as in this case, we're talking about, what are we talking about, 1,800 years. I'm sorry, 1,600 years, but not, certainly not the early test, the papyrus. And the papyri we do have, the only reason why we do have some papyri from that time period is because of the Dead Sea Scrolls. They were isolated in caves underground in cool areas and in a dry environment, and that's the only reason why they've lasted 2,000 years. But you would not expect that for the New Testament documents. But there is no excuse, therefore, for the Arab documents. Muslims have tried to come back to me and say, hold on a minute, we would not expect to have manuscripts from the time of the 7th century because they were oral, they were illiterate people. Muhammad was illiterate. And I say, stop and think. Even your traditions tell me that the Quran was written down. It was rewritten down. Again, there was many manuscripts that had to be destroyed. Who wrote those manuscripts if they were not literate? Who was Zayd ibn Thabit? Who was Alas, Zubair, Hadith? Who were these individuals? Who was Ubay ibn Ka'b? All these individuals were writers. They were compilers. They were secretaries. But more than that, remember, they didn't live and they didn't stay in the Hijaz. Within 10 years, they had taken Basra, Baghdad, Damascus, Jerusalem, and Cairo, the five great cities of the Levant. All those cities came under their jurisdiction within 10 years of Muhammad's death. Those cities had libraries. There was no excuse not to have the Quran written down by the 7th century. Certainly not these hadith, or the sirah, or the tafsir of the tariq. You cannot tell me that you had to wait 200 years to get this written down. Obviously, something happened back here that either there was no rate, there was written down and they were destroyed, or there was an awful lot of manipulation going on in between. Now, this is what a new school of Orientalists who are coming out basically out of Britain have been asking. A man named Dr. John Wansborough. Do any of you know that name? You know that name, Peter. Dr. John Wansborough started this, didn't really start it. It's been going on for quite a few years in the German school, Noldecke and Goldziher, you know that, them. Schacht, men like Arthur Jeffrey. But really in 1977, Dr. John Wansborough wrote two books that really blew this wide open called Quranic Studies and Sectarian Milieu, 1976 and 1977, there at the School of Oriental and African Studies. And basically he asked this very question. He said, if you look at all this compilation of material that should have been written back there, when you start and look at the Quran, you'll see that it is based on an awful lot of literary traditions, which we now can identify only begin to appear in the 8th century. Much of it has been borrowed from other pieces of literature. Let me give you an example. When you look at the Quran, remember we talked about these biblical stories that you see in the Quran, stories of Suleiman. And let's see, look at your paper here. Let's just jump to that so we can get into it real quickly. Look on page 4, Talmudic sources. Cain and Abel, Surah 3. Surah 5, Ayah 31 and 32 that I mentioned about earlier. If you look at that story, you ask, why is that story not in our Bible? Well, the story does exist. You will find the exact same story in the Targum of Jonathan ben Uzziah, also the Targum of Jerusalem, the Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer. But the story does not talk about, the story of the raven does not have any reference to the blood of Abel. That is found in the Mishnah Sanhedrin. What is interesting, Mishnah Sanhedrin, the first copy of the Mishnah Sanhedrin that we have, has the story of the raven, but on the margins it has an editorial comment written by the scribe who is in the process of copying it over. And it is he who is surmising off the top of his head what it would be, what would the significance of the blood of Abel, that if one were to destroy, to kill one man, as if he did killed all men, or if one were to save the life of one man, as if he did save the life of all men. That's an editorial comment in the margins. The next time the copy of the Sanhedrin was written down, that editorial comment is incorporated into the text in the 6th century A.D. Fascinating, the story of the raven plus the editorial comment finds its way into the Quran in Surah 5, Ayah 31 and 32. We know who wrote it. We know when it was written. In this case, we even know why it was written. It's fascinating that once you start looking at the source of these stories, you can start pinning them down. Abraham, Surah 21. Abraham wakes up in the middle of the night. He sees all these idols, gets disgusted with the idols, gets up in the middle of the night, takes a large idol, and destroys all the smaller idols. Next morning, people get up, they see all the destroyed idols, they go to Abraham and say, what have you done? He said, well, go talk to the bigger idol. They said, we can't talk to him. So they take him, they throw him into a fiery pit. The angel of the Lord comes down and rescues him from the fiery pit. Is that story in your Bible? No. So where does it come from? We've now found it. You can find it in the Midrash Rabbah, almost exactly word for word, the same story. Solomon and Sheba, this one I love, in Surah 21. Solomon has a large number of birds that he trains for battle, and he trains them to go fly above the enemy with stones on their talons with the name of the enemy that they're going to kill when they drop the stone. One day, as he's training his birds, the hoopoe bird's not there. He gets angry. Where's my hoopoe bird? Suddenly, the hoopoe bird appears in the south and flies, lands at his feet, and talks to Solomon. Solomon talks to birds and says, I've been down south. I've seen this beautiful queen in Sheba. You must see her. So Solomon sends him back down south to talk to the queen. The bird flies down, talks to the queen. The queen talks to the birds and says, you must come see this great king in the north. So she goes up with her retinue, goes up to Jerusalem, goes into the palace of Jerusalem, goes into the throne room, and there's Solomon sitting on the throne. He has a mirrored floor. She's never seen a mirrored floor. They don't have that kind of technology in Sheba. She thinks it's she thinks it's water. So she picks up her skirts to keep them from getting wet, and that's where the story ends in Surah 27. Where do you think the story is? Is it in your Bible? It's a great story. It's very entertaining. It's not in my Bible, so where does it come from? You can find the exact same story, word for word, almost exactly the same, with the hoopoe bird and all the rest, in the second Targum of Esther. The only difference is that in the second Targum of Esther, when she picks up her skirt, she has hairy legs. Solomon cries out in surprise upon seeing her hairy legs. That part has been excised out of the story to sanitize it for the Quran. But other than that, every word for word is found in the Quran, in Surah 27, as the second Targum of Esther, written in the 6th century. Go ahead.
Did you say that it is word for word?
Exactly. If you go up on my website, you can see the paper. I put the two side by side. You can read it side by side. You can see it's borrowed from this source. Now, you might say, hold on a minute. Maybe these sources, they are the authentic word of God. And this is what Muslims are trying to tell me, that these are actually the real word of God. What you have is something that's been added much later. The problem is we can date these sources. We know who wrote them. Many of them are written as Targums. They are basically made up of the Talmudic sources. These are apocryphal accounts. They were never considered to be authoritative by the Jews. Many of them were written in the diaspora when they had moved out, when Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD. And as they came upon these other groups of people in the diaspora who were relating their histories and their stories, they would take those stories, which were orally transmitted, and they would put biblical names to them. And many of them were there for entertainment of the children. They were never considered to be authoritative. They were certainly never to ever be put on alongside the scriptural accounts. And the interesting thing is, if you are an Arab who comes across these type of stories, if you've not seen the original Bible, because remember, the Bible had not yet been translated, the Old or the New Testament had not been fully translated into Arabic, was not done so until the late 8th century. So therefore, they would not have had access to the original accounts. The only accounts they would have had access to would be these oral traditions that have been written down, usually in the vernacular, and that's one reason why so many of them now have been incorporated into the Quran. A lot of them have been written in Syriac, and this is where Peter has been is studying. This is his area of expertise. It's the Syriac that has been interposed into and taken into the Quran. The same thing can be found with many of the New Testament stories of Jesus, Mary, Imran, and Zachariah. Surah 3:35. We've now found the exact same story in Photo Evangelion's James the Lesser. Jesus' birth. Lots of stories surrounding Jesus' birth in Surah 19:22. This is an apocryphal fable from the last book of the Bibles, where he bends down the palm tree and takes the fruit off it as a child, where he talks from the crib as a baby and tells the wise men who are there what he's doing and why he's come. In Surah 19, that comes from the first gospel of the infancy of Jesus Christ. Or when he takes the six clay birds, fashions them into birds, into clay, from the clay into birds, and blows on them, and they fly off into the air. That story is found in Thomas's Gospel, the infancy of Jesus Christ. We are almost able to source most all the stories that are found in the Quran. We can now source back to either sectarian writings, Docetic, Monastic, Colloridian, Surah 5:116, which talks about the Trinity being made up of God the Father, Mary the Mother, and Jesus the Son, from a Colloridian account. That is found from a 5th century document. Almost all of these can either be found in sectarian writings from the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, up into 5th century, or apocryphal accounts, Talmudic accounts, Jewish Talmudic writings from the 5th and 6th century. Now there's a new material that's coming out. Two scholars in Germany, one named Luxemburg, that's not his real name, but I'm not privy to let you know what his real name is, and another man named Dr. Gunther Luning, a good friend of mine, have now gone back and looked at this poetry that we were talking about earlier, this beautiful poetry that you find in the Quran. About 30% of the Quran is made up of this poetry. When he's looked at this poetry, he's recognized that he's seen this poetry before. And this man is a Syriac scholar, and he's gone back and he's been able to find almost every one of these beautiful poetic strophes, almost word for word. He has been able to trace them back to pre-Islamic Christian hymns written in Syriac in the 5th and 6th century, and then interposed into Arabic. And his book has just come out last year, and we were most responsible for getting it translated into English. It came out in German about 15 years ago, and now it's been translated into English. Dr. Luxemburg did much the same work, came to the exact same conclusion, and his book is causing a huge storm right now in Islamic circles, because it's basically saying that much of this beautiful poetry that is credited Muhammad is actually, should be credited Christians who wrote it, writing it in Syriac. Can you see what this does to the Quran, though? Can you see what it does also to the claims many Muslims are making about their text? Let's continue on. When you want to go back, then you need to ask, then, if everything that we get about how the Quran was put together, everything we know about how Islam began comes from this time period, should we not maybe go back to this time period and find out what really actually happened? And this is what Dr. John Wansborough started to do. And two of his students, Dr. Patricia Corona and Dr. Michael Cook, decided to do just that. They decided to go back to this time period, and they came up with a book in 1975 called Hagerism, just before he wrote his two pivotal books. Hagerism was a what-if scenario, and it's caused a huge amount of anger in the Muslim world and even in the Orientalist world, because it looked at all the documents that we could find, as many as it could find from the 7th and 8th century. If you look at it, you'll see almost half the pages are source material, and tried to put together a scenario of what actually did happen, because people were writing back in the 7th century. People who were being conquered by these Arabs were writing. People in the 8th century were writing about what was going on. And so it was going to that material, to that time period, that they decided to try to reconstruct what actually happened in Islam. And let's start doing that right now, looking at the documentary problems and then looking over at the archaeological. Before we do that, let me just jump back to the scripts. Before we go on to the historical problems in the Quran, can we jump back to page number 3 and let's just look at the manuscripts itself. When you talk about the Quran, if we're looking at the hadith and the traditions, we need to also ask, what about the Quran itself? Where does it come from? And here's where you're getting to some very dangerous material. This is material that we have had a lot of problems with because it's obviously very controversial. What are you going to do with the earliest manuscripts? Where are they? If at the time of Uthman, a final copy was made by Zayd ibn Thabit, Zubair al-Hasan Harith, and that became the standard canonized text, what we call the Uthmanic recensions that Muslims claim is this Quran right here. Where are the manuscripts of those texts? And if you ask your Muslim friends, and do so, ask them where those manuscripts are. There's no reason that they should not be in existence, because as I said earlier, from the 4th century on, there's a proliferation of manuscripts using vellum, using parchment. We have about 230 manuscripts or portions of manuscripts of the New Testament alone from before the 6th century. Certainly you can come up with one manuscript of the Quran from the 7th century. Muslims will claim that there are two manuscripts that still exist today from the 7th century. They call it, one is called the Topkapi manuscript, which I'll give you a picture of right here, and the other one is called the Samarkand. Here's the Topkapi manuscript in Istanbul. In Turkey. And you can see it right there. And if you were to look at that, it would look like an archaic text. There's nothing to really delineate it from anything else other than the fact that it has a script that is now in doubt. Peter, can you identify that script? Could you, off the top of your head, identify it? Why would you say it's pre-Kufic?
Well, no, it's got extended letters, so...
And how do you know the extended letters have to do with Kufic? And what he's doing is actually what the scriptologists are doing right now, too. Men like Dr. François de Roche in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, he's the one that is actually looking at these manuscripts and starting to date them. Because when I look at that, immediately I see there's a problem with the script. I can't touch this. We're not permitted to do any forensic evidence on this. No one can do. It would be great if we could date them using some accelerated mass spectrography or doing some way of trying to find a date on it, but they won't let us touch them. But just look at the script, you can see that there's a problem right there. The elongated lettering here immediately identifies it as a Kufic script. It's actually the second school of the Kufic script, according to François de Roche. And what he's telling us, that this actually is a text that would not have come into existence till after the mid-8th century.
Can I just say something?
Go ahead.
I'm not at all familiar with Arabic script, but what really strikes me is the punctuation marks. Here, these we have in Syriac manuscripts from the 4th and 5th century.
Now, that's not punctuation. You know what those are?
No.
Those are versification.
Versification, yeah, but I mean, that style of punctuation develops a while. So, I mean, in terms of literature...
When do these develop in the Syriac text?
I mean, they're being used through a huge range of style, and they're not consistent, but they're very Syriac influence.
You wouldn't have any dates for that. Versification was only delineated in the late 8th century, and the fact that there's verses here, in here, and here, shows that this is certainly a late 8th century, possibly even later than that. Muslims would like to claim that this is a mid-7th century text that's Uthmanic. But right away, we can see this cannot be Uthmanic because of the type of styles of letters, the versification, the pagination, the fact that there's justified sides, and the landscape format, the elongated format, which was only borrowed from the Syriac text again in the late 8th century. So Muslim scholars today now are finally admitting that this is a 9th century manuscript, not a 7th century manuscript. We can also look at the coins. When you go to the British Museum, you go to room number 65, and... you will see the coins. I think I have a picture of the coins here. You can see how the coins show how the text evolved. Here is a Hijazi text, which is an older archaic text that would have been in existence in the 7th century. This particular manuscript comes from the Mu'ilg manuscript, which is in the British Library, the 2165 manuscript, considered to be around the second to probably the third oldest Quran in existence. And it's dated to the late 8th century. But that's a Hijazi, it's a Mu'ilg text, it's a slanted text. And it was very similar to the type of text that was on the coins at that time. But when these coins were introduced by the Abbasids, this elongated lines between manuscripts can be easily identified. That same type of text you'll see, this is part of the Samarkand manuscript, which is a sister copy to the Topkapi. So what we're saying is these earliest Qurans, because of the type of script that is used, the coins show us that these could have only been introduced around the mid-8th century, about 100 years after what the Muslims are telling us. So what happened to that intervening 100 years? What happened to the 7th and 8th century manuscripts? Where are they? Where are those original texts? We can't find one. But a new discovery happened in 1975 when they were cleaning out the Sana Mosque. They came across the dome and they came across a trapdoor. They opened the trapdoor and thousands of manuscripts fell to the ground. Amongst them were some very old manuscripts whose text they couldn't read. And so they flew down in 1981, this individual here. Now, I'm not going to put him up on the overhead because I have to be careful about showing him in public. He'd be a little upset if I show him too much. This is Dr. Gerd Puin. Dr. Gerd Puin and Dr. von Bothmer were flown down in 1981 to look at the text. They are considered probably the world's authority on the Arabic script, ancient archaic Arabic script. And they took microfilms of this text, and immediately their microfilms were confiscated. They could not look at their own microfilms until 1997. 1997, they were finally given access to them by the Yemeni government. And I went to visit him in Germany about 3 years ago, and he showed me the text. This is a photocopy, okay? This is not the original manuscript. Muslims get upset when they see that he has marked it up. This is a photocopy only. On this side, you will see Hijazi script. On this side, you will see Kufic script. But it's a later Kufic script. Remember, there are about six different schools of Kufic script. What is interesting is you have Surah 19. Now, we know it's Surah 19. It's not written Surah 19. Has Surah 19 up to this yellow mark here, and then it jumps to Surah 22. What happened to Surah 20 and 21? Surah 20 begins over here on this side of the page in a completely different script, a much later script. It's been interjected, interposed. What's that start to tell you? Any ideas? Well, what it's telling Dr. Garrett Puin and what it's telling Dr. von Bothmer is it looks like you have an evolution in the manuscript. They date this script here to about 705, early 8th century. They date this to the late 8th century, about 60, 70 years later. Can you see what's going on? But remember, Muhammad died in 632. The Quran was supposed to have been codified and canonized in 650. Yet even in 705, it's still not complete. And this is not the only place. Time and time after time, you will see it jumps, complete surahs are missing. It jumps all over the place. Now, they are just now beginning to publish what they know. It's very dangerous because obviously they're going to be blacklisted. But can you see what this is starting to show? Basically, for the first time, we now have manuscript evidence to support what Dr. John Wandsworth was probably saying, what Dr. Patricia Corona and Dr. Cook were saying earlier, and that is it looks like that the Quran was not canonized, was not complete at all during the time of Uthman. It looked like it was still evolving and still incorporating a lot of these stories which would have come together in the 8th century. Much of the Quran as we know it probably is a mid-8th century invention and probably still was not completely canonized until the late 8th century. That's about 100 years later. Once the Quran had come into existence, you've got to start asking, what about some of the other areas? Now, let's just jump then to page, and here's where we really need to run because I want to try to get this done in the next 5 minutes so you can have questions. Let's look on page 4 to Mecca. Dr. Patricia Corona was my supervisor for a while when she was at Cambridge. She's a real fighter. She's from Denmark. And she came out with a book in 1987, called Meccan Trade and the Rise of Islam. And she asked some very salient questions. She says, hold it, what do we know about Mecca? Now, there's Mecca on the map. What do we know about Mecca? Just give me some claims. What do Muslims tell us about Mecca? Okay, it's a great trading city. It's a center of trade from Gaza in the north to Aden in the south. It's a center of trade from over here, Adulis in the west, over to Ctesiphon or up here, which is today Baghdad in the east. It was a center of trade. What else? It's where the sanctuary was. How old is it? The sanctuary were there, yeah, the Kaaba. But how old would Mecca be, do you think? Guess. We know that Abraham and Ishmael went to Mecca to rebuild the Kaaba. It had already existed. According to some hadith, Adam and Eve were thrown out of heaven. When they were thrown out of heaven, they were thrown down to Mecca. So it looks like a pretty old city.
I don't remember the name
of the early text. Okay, good. Hold on to that. Hold on to it right there. We're getting to that. But certainly it's a very old city, right? Probably one of the oldest cities in history. So Dr. Patricia Corona asked some very good questions. As a good historian, she said, well, hold on a minute. If it's one of the oldest cities, if it's one of the greatest cities, and certainly one of the most important cities in the 5th, 6th, and up until the 7th century, certainly the time Muhammad was living, when he was born in 570, up until the time that certainly he came to take over. And certainly we know that it was from Mecca to Medina that the Hijrah happened, that exodus from Mecca to Medina in 622. Then certainly it's one of the greatest cities in that part of the world, and certainly people would have known about it. So she decided to find out what they knew about it. And she came to the same conclusion you've come to, Peter, and that is she couldn't find any reference to it. Nobody seemed to know about it. So she decided to go back earlier. She decided to go back, well, see what people earlier knew about it. And so she went back to the time period of Pliny in the first and second centuries. She went up to Procopius, Cosmas, Theodoretus. These are the Greek travelers they were travelers who were writing what they had heard, and they talk about Taif here. They talk about Yathrib, which is the ancient name for Medina. Khaybar in the north, they talk about all these other oases along what is known as the trade route. And then as she started looking at these names, she noticed that no reference at all was no reference at all to Mecca. And then she looked at the trade route again. Now, can you see the green line up there on that map? What is it you notice about that green line? It goes up the western coast, up on top of the plateau, and follows through all these oases. It comes to Taif, and suddenly it goes down to Mecca, off the plateau, about 1,000 feet, and it comes back up to Yathrib, to get up onto the plateau again to Yathrib. She says, hold on a minute. It's not on the trade route. Mecca is not on the plateau. It's off the plateau. The caravans would have had to go all the way down 1,000 feet, then back up 1,000 feet. What's more, there's only one well in Mecca, the Zamzam well. It could not have accommodated huge caravans. Why hadn't anybody asked these questions before, she asked. And then she says, hold on, what do the great Orientalists, men like Montgomery Watt, tell us about how Mecca got its riches? Well, what Montgomery Watt came up with is what he known as the trade route theory. The trade that came from India and China in the east would come across up through the Persian Gulf in this area. But then we had the great wars between the Sassanids, who are this area here, and the Byzantines. The Byzantines up here and the Sassanids. And during the wars, that shut down the trade. So instead of the Persian Gulf, they had to redirect the trade over to this area. And according to Montgomery Watt, they disembarked all the goods here at Aden, and they went up 1,250 miles through Mecca all the way up to the north. And Mecca controlled that trade for these 1,250 miles, and that's why they enriched themselves. That's how Mecca got its riches. That's why the 15 spices that were then grown in Mecca also enriched them, and that's why it was such a great city of that time. And that's how we get the trade route theory. And most Orientalists have always used that theory as to how Mecca got its riches and how Muhammad therefore needed to have control of it so they could control that whole area of the world. The difficulty, she went back and she decided to find out if that was correct. And if you look at her book, she spends a chapter per spice. And what she found is of the 15 spices that they that Muslims claim to have been grown there, only two were grown in Arabia at all, and they were grown down here in the Hadramaut area. None of them were grown at all in Arabia. Most of them were either grown in Africa or over in Asia. But what was most curious, she went on, she looked, and she said, well, what about the trade that did exist there? She said, there was a real problem with that theory, and my 10-year-old son saw it right away. Let's see if any of you can find it. See if you're as clever as my 10-year-old son. What is wrong with that theory that Montgomery Watt came up with and the Muslims have adopted since then? Say again? Exactly. There you go. See, why do you disembark all the goods here and travel 1,255 miles by land if you have a waterway going up the west? Because what Dr. Patricia Corona found, if you take a ton of goods, you can go 1,250 miles by sea. The same expense, you could only go 50 miles by land. It would have been prohibitively expensive to go over land with all those goods. And what she found from what the historians were telling her is that there was no overland route. It was all maritime. And the Meccans had nothing to do with it. There was no reference to any city called Mecca in any of the trading documents. When she looked at the trading documents, it was Adulis that came up over and over again in all the trading documents. They knew about the Adulis way over here in India. They controlled the sea because they're on the sea. They were seafarers. The Arabs were never seafarers. They were people on camels. They knew nothing about the sea. The trade was not overland at all. The only trade she could find that went overland was milk and leather. Not spices. She says, hold on a minute, we've got a real problem here. And then she asked and she said, what about the Kaaba? When she went back and looked at the sources back then, now remember, she's a linguist. She speaks about 15 languages and she reads in those languages. And when she writes a book, she doesn't bother to translate them. She keeps them in the original text. It's horrible. I don't know if you had that problem, Peter, but you can speak about six yourself. But for people like us who are not linguists in that category, it's difficult to read her books. But at least she footnotes them at the bottom. And what she found is that when you go back in this area of the world, you will see that not only do they not talk about Mecca, there is no reference at all to any place called Mecca until 724. It's not till 724 that you find the first reference to Mecca. Remember, Muhammad died in 632. That's almost 100 years later. Now, we don't have time to go into all. Let's just jump ahead. I don't have time to get into the Jews or to the Dome of the Rock or the Qibla or the Naval's inscription. There's a lot of material that we're going to have to skip over because we're just running out of time. But when you look at it all, just look at the conclusions that they've come to. And these are the conclusions they've come to. Now, I did a debate in 1995 with Dr. Jamal Badawi, who's considered one of the world's leading authorities on the Quran in the English language. He lives in Halifax, and he travels all over the world doing debates. He's done about 350 video videos on the Quran, and he and I did a debate at Cambridge University in 1995 on the Quran, and I gave these 10 challenges to him that I'm going to read to you right here. These are all 10 challenges that Dr. Patricia looked over to make sure that I was correct, using her material, using Michael Cook's material, using Wansborough's material, using Andrew Rippon in Canada, there's a few others I can't remember off the top of my head. And this is the conclusions they came to. Now, let's just read what they found. We haven't had time to support every one of them because we're all running out of time. First and foremost, the Hijrah, that's the movement from Mecca to Medina that Muslims claim was in 622, was not towards Medina from Mecca, but looks like almost all the reference. Patricia Corona has done a study on the Hijrah and has found over 56 references to the Hijrah in material from the 7th and 8th century, and almost all of it was a movement from Arabia up to the north, most often to Palestine. And it was a Hijrah after Hijrah. It wasn't just one Hijrah. There are many references to Hijrah. It was a whole lifetime of Exodus, in many cases. And this is the most damaging architecturally. The Qibla was not fixed towards Mecca. We didn't go into Dr. Creswell, who has done the standard work on early Islamic architecture. Back in 1905, when it was still open, you could travel in that area of the world. He could not go to Medina, he could not go to Mecca, so he went to the earliest mosque that he could find. And he found two mosques in what is today, present-day Iraq. Where's my map here? Oh, it's right there. He found two mosques in this area of the world up here, just below Stesfeld, in this area. One called the Kufa Mosque, and one is called the Wasat Mosque. And he dug down to the original floor plans of these mosques. It came down to the 7th century, around 660 and 680, respectively. And he found that the Qibla, or the direction of prayer for these mosques, the Mihrab, which is built into the structure, were both facing west, not south. If they're in 660 and 680, they should be facing towards Mecca. None of them were facing towards Mecca. He went over here to Egypt, to Fustut, outside of which was the garrison town outside of Cairo, and he found that original floor plan. When he looked at that original floor plan, he found that Qibla was facing east. It should have been facing southeast. So in the west, they were facing east. In the east, they're facing west. Where do you think they're facing? He found that also... The Qibla was not fixed towards Mecca until the 8th century, but to an area further north and possibly, looks like, to Jerusalem. That the Jews still retained a relationship with the Arabs at least until 640 AD. Looking at some of the tracts that have come out from the early 7th century, the Doctrina Iacobi, which is in the British Museum, supports the fact that Muhammad was still alive at that time. Muhammad is historical, there's not a problem with that. But it looked like he was alive as late as 640, not 632. And that there was still a relationship with the Jews as late as 640. It looks like, according to what the tracts are telling us, that the first governor of Jerusalem, when it was finally conquered by the Arabs, was a Jew. They made a Jew the first governor of Jerusalem. That Mecca was not only unknown as a viable city until the end of the 7th century, but was not even on the trade route, as we saw on that map. That the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, which was built in 691 by Abdul al-Malik, was possible position of an early sanctuary in the late 7th century, and used basically built as a polemic against Christianity. If you look at all the earliest inscriptions, which should have been referring to the reason why that building was built, has nothing at all to do with the reason it's given today, with his flight, his movement, that great night of power when he moved up to the seven heavens. All the earliest inscriptions on the inner ambulatory of that building all speak of anti-Trinitarian references, Surah 5116 and so on. It's basically a polemic against Christianity. That Muhammad was not even known as God's universal prophet until the late 7th century. That the words Muslim and Islam, those terms, aren't even found in any inscriptions or any documents until the end of the 7th century. And that the word that they use for themselves and all their references we see are either Saracen, Mahagrai, Muhajirun, or Hagarin. Basically, these are words that refer to the fact that they come in the line of Hagar, Ishmaelites, which are quite well known at that time, in that period. That the five daily prayers, as well as the Hajj, were not standardized until 717 AD and not named until the 9th century. Look in your Quran. I ask your Muslim friends to find five prayers in the Quran. You won't find five prayers in the Quran. You'll find three prayers. The Quran refers to Salat five times, and always it refers to three prayers. The Jews pray three times a day. The five prayers as we know today, the canonized prayers, were only introduced in the 9th century. It is Bukhari that tells us about five prayers. But that's not till the 9th century. You've got a real problem there. That the earliest we hear of any complete Quran is not until the mid-8th century, though fragments exist in the late 7th century and the early 8th century. And that the earliest Quranic writings do not coincide exactly with the current Quranic text. If you look at this picture again, you notice all those orange marks? You can see the orange marks there? Every one of those orange marks is what we call a manuscript variant. That means words or phrases in this text that is not parallel to the Quran, the Kyrene text that we have in our hand today. There's over 1,000 of them in just this manuscript that Dr. Garrett Queen has identified. Now, what I've told you, don't pass on. He has not published what I've just said. He's only told me this face to face. Maybe I shouldn't have told you that. He's scared to publish what he knows, because you can see the danger of what he's saying. Basically, what he has found is the earliest text that they can come across, there is no earlier text that we've been able to identify and date. This is possibly the earliest manuscript we have for any Quran. This text has over 1,000 manuscript variants. The Samarkand that we now have access to, Princeton University gave us a copy. I have it on my computer at home. The Samarkand has, we've already found about 100 manuscript variants. The Topkapi, the Samarkand, all the earliest manuscripts that we can get our hands on only go up to around Surah 41 to Surah 43. We do not have a complete Quran. Although this Quran does have some surahs from Surah 76 and Surah in the 60s. So it's one of the few ones that does have later surahs. But can you see what we're talking about? If the Muslims claim that the Quran has never been changed, if the Muslims claim that you can trace the manuscript evidence for the Quran right back to the time of Muhammad, which manuscript are they talking about? Which Quran are they referring to? Why is it that the earliest manuscripts do not agree with the Quran that we have today? And why is it they're not doing reference or any material or any published work on it? There has not been one published work done on any of the earliest Qurans by any Muslim. And the ones that have done by Christians, or I'm sorry, not Christians, by Westerners and Orientalists, say very little. They do not want to say what they know. It's a huge danger. Now, this is difficult to use in public. Be careful how you use it. It's good. It's good for you to know that this material is there. It's good for you to know that there are difficulties with the Quran. What you can use is the material concerning the internal evidence, the earliest part of that material, looking at the contradictions, looking at the errors, looking at what the Muslims claim concerning the Quran. Be careful about the historical evidence. Unless you know what you're saying, unless you can back up what you're saying, you may get into a huge amount of arguments with a lot of Muslims. There are some Muslims that are able to take this. I've done about 10 to 11 debates on this material, historical material, on university campuses, but I'll only do them on university campuses, where they can take this material, where they can work with it. We've had some Muslims who've left Islam because of this material. It is dangerous. It is hugely controversial. But can you see why this material is so important for the future? Because it's the radical Muslims today, the ones who are causing all the problem, who go to the Quran and basically substantiate everything they do because they believe this is divine writ. How are you going to defeat those men? How are you going to take on the radical Muslims? We can't do it with bombs, bullets, and cruise missiles as much as Tony Blair and George Bush think we can. You're not going to eradicate the radical face of Islam by using violence. But one way we can eradicate the radical face of Islam is by eradicating their foundations, at least bringing the Quran down to earth and showing that it was written by men, that it evolved over a long period of years, that even the earliest Quran does not agree with the Quran that we have today, that it's evolved using borrowed text, and that much of it we can trace back to much of it, Talmudic material, early Christian sectarian material, and even Christian hymns. And it is this Quran, man-made, nothing more. I don't think those Christians would consider it to be divine text any more than the Talmudic writers would consider it to be divine text. But that's all we have. It's an amalgamation of many different manuscripts, many different oral traditions written down, not over a period of 23 years, as Muslims like to believe, but possibly a period of 50 to 60, maybe even 100 to 150 years. That makes sense. But this destroys an awful lot, the whole foundations of what Islam is standing for. Certainly the radical extremists are using. Now, we've almost run out of time. Are there any questions you might have?
How is this going to get settled to the public domain eventually?
I think the only way you can do it is through debate. We'd use it in London all the time. I use it. It has lots of... certainly, it is confrontational. It's very confrontational. But I think we need to. And I think probably the only people that can really use this material are Christians, because I know the Orientalists do not want to use it. When I started going down to Speaker's Corner and started using it, I got beat up very quickly. I was attacked by 60 Muslims, and I was knocked unconscious. And the police came to me and asked me to get up on a ladder so they could watch me at all times after that. And it's ever since, that was in 1995. And since 1995, I only speak from ladders now so the police can always see what I'm doing. But still, sometimes they have to come protect me. It's very volatile. We're doing it at a place like Speaker's Corner because it's one of the only places on earth that we can actually take it out publicly and start dealing with it.
How could this kind of information get into the wider Islamic world and other?
On the internet, we have this. Everything I've said to you right now is up on my website. You can read it.
The latter half that you're saying.
That's all up there. It's all up there. You go up my Is the Quran the Word of God? You can go up there, and it's I have about 80 books that are in the bibliography that you can read, and anybody can read it. People are reading it. They're coming back to us on it. Muslims are coming back to us on it. That's one way, but it's going to take people like you and me to actually get it into the public forum. And we're training people in London to do that right now. We're training people to go in to get into this material and start challenging Muslims to debate on it. But I, for the first 5 years, I would only attack the Quran. I don't do that anymore. I take the Bible alongside it, and I ask the same questions of the Bible that I'm asking of the Quran. Look at the manuscript of the Bible versus the manuscripts of the Quran. Look at the documentary evidence of each. Look at the archaeological evidence of each. I do not just want to attack the Quran without providing them an alternative. I find that a lot more effective because we come out high and dry compared to what they have. And it's so nice to see that comparative and realize that though this historical criticism eradicates much of the foundations of the Quran, when applied to the Bible, though there are still problems with the Bible, nothing along the lines there. And certainly, we don't make the claims about the Bible they make about their Quran. And that's the great thing. We don't have to support what they're supporting. But the problem is nobody is taking and nobody is really challenging their claims. We've got to do it. The Orientalists won't. Some have. I mean, like Toby Lester in the Atlantic Monthly did so in 2000, and he caused a huge stir. But most journalists don't want to touch it. I think one of the problems is there is a reticence to use any of this material, or there's even a reticence to even expose radical Muslims, because most journalists would like to believe that Islam has nothing to do with the radical element, that Islam is much more moderate, and it's basically a postmodernist view of Islam, and that's the Islam they want to foment. That's the type of Islam they want to certainly support. And it's difficult if they're going to start attacking radicals. You're going to be, as we are, anytime you start attacking radicals, you're going to put your head above the parapet. You're going to be attacked very quickly. It's difficult for because of what happened to Salman Rushdie. Difficult for a really journalist to take that on board. A guy named Tahir tried to do it about 2 years ago in The Guardian. No, just last year in The Guardian, and he had lots of problems from the Orientalist establishment and also the Muslim establishment. So it's difficult. So if they're not going to do it, we can. And I think we have a remit that's different than theirs because we have Paul as an example. He did it. And in some ways, it's a great work that we have. I think in some ways it's terrific because those of us who do believe in the Bible as the Word of God and who do also use the same criteria, who can understand why the Muslims are making the claims they can make, can by far probably get into that arena quicker than anybody else.